Well, good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to get started here right away. We have a good amount of material to cover in a relatively short amount of time. So we are in the book of Revelation today. And I just want to say right off the bat that I won't be answering all of your questions about how to interpret Revelation. In fact, I'm not going to answer any specific questions about Revelation. So if you've got your favorite verse or whatever, or your puzzle that you've wondered about for a long, long time, this isn't a survey class, all right? Survey class, all right? Well, we are in Revelation, and we just want to think about the book as a whole and give just a few basic structural things to help us as you think about interpreting the book and reading the book on your own. So there's a lot in it, and it's one of the longer New Testament books, so we can't possibly, you know, exhaust that or even hardly scratch the surface of the material in the book itself. But we'll give some structural things just to help you make sure you're clear in how to think about the book. Now, just in general, we need to first of all start by noting that we are in kind of a new genre of material, and that is of New Testament prophecy. So way back when we started through our survey, New Testament survey, we spent some time talking about different kinds of material that's in the New Testament. And we talked about the Gospels, which are sort of a historical biography of sorts. We talked about the epistles, or that means letters. And then we did mention that there's a third section of the New Testament, and that is of prophecy. And that would come here. This is, at least at some, a major portion of Revelation is a prophetic book. Whereas when you go in the Old Testament, you have lots of books that are almost wholly dedicated to prophecy. That's not necessarily the case in the New Testament. So let's just think about prophecy as an idea, the kind of literature it is, right away. All right, so this is just kind of just a few thoughts about New Testament prophecy. So, as I mentioned, prophecies are found scattered throughout the New Testament. However, the book of Revelation is the only New Testament book that is properly classified as a prophetic book. So let me make sure you're clear on that. We're not saying that there's no prophecy in Matthew. We're going to get to some of that. Or that there's no prophecy in the book of Romans. There is. Okay. We're saying that this book is, on the whole, a prophetic book, whereas the others may contain prophecy. And this classification reflects both the context of the book and its self-designation. John, the author of Revelation, makes it very clear that he is dealing with prophetic elements himself. So a little more about the genre then, or the type of literature of the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is a unique literary creation. I say that because not only is it unique from the rest of the New Testament letters, it's also really unique if you start combing through ancient Greco-Roman letters, let's say from the end of, about the first century BC all the way up to like the third century AD, you're just not going to find a letter exactly or a document exactly like the book of Revelation. It is a little bit unique. Most interpreters are willing to acknowledge that the book of Revelation is comprised of three literary genres or types of material. First is epistle. Remember, that word means letter. The second is prophecy. And the third is that of apocalypse or apocalyptic literature. Now, the epistolatory nature of the book is seen in its opening in verses 1 through 8 of chapter 1. also the closing of the book. There's an introduction and there's a closing of the book. And also in chapters 2 through 3, in the letters to the seven churches, you know, you have the one to Ephesus and Sardis and Philadelphia and so on. In each one of those, it's very much like a letter format that we see in most of the rest of the New Testament outside the Gospels. The prophetic nature of the book is seen in the fact that the book claims to recount future events. It explicitly says that these things are future. And the apocalyptic nature of the book of Revelation is seen in most in its use of vision, angelic guides, in symbolic descriptions and numbers. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. So three types of literature within this one book. That's what makes it so unique. You're just not going to find that in other books or other documents, even in the ancient world as a whole. Now, let's just think about this term, apocalyptic, and the book of Revelation. Now, there are a lot of questions, and this is worthy of, if you want to geek out, there's plenty of stuff to read on this out there. There are a lot of questions about the genre of apocalyptic literature, including its origin. Where did this come from? Its definition and its relationship to biblical prophecy. Apocalyptic literature is not unique to the Old and the New Testaments. You can find very similar type of literature in books outside of them. Now, although apocalyptic, though, this is something that sometimes people don't realize. Apocalyptic literally means the uncovering or revelation. So when you read the revelation of Jesus Christ, that's the title for your book, it's literally the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. And that is actually, that word is used in John, or in Revelation. So, Revelation, apocalypse. Apocalypse is literally the Greek word for it there. Now, although the term was not used until modern times as a designation for a type of genre, a type of literature, the term has been applied to a number of Jewish and Christian works that bear similar characteristics, including revelatory communication, angelic mediation, an angel gives you insight or ideas, symbolism, a heavy dose of pessimism, 5, an anticipation of God's judgment, also the promise of salvation or restoration, sometimes a recital of history, and also, pseudonymity. That's a fancy word that means somebody writing in the name of somebody else. So there you can find examples of this type of literature. Both early Christians used this, and also some Jewish people used this as well. Now, one of the questions that comes up, and I would love to like spend 20 minutes talking about this and illustrating it. But one of the questions that comes up is, why would you use this type of literature? Okay, because you read in Revelation, and if you go read First Enoch and other books like that, you're going to find this type of literature. And you go, why would you do that? My basic answer, my short answer, and I could give a whole talk on this, and it'd be actually a lot of fun. You can illustrate a lot of ways. But my basic answer is, sometimes when you're trying to communicate things that are so fantastic to the mind, you have to use fantastic ideas to capture the imagination. And even just at the simple prophetic level, if you think about where John is writing from, and if we assume that he's writing about something that's now almost 2,000 years after him, how would you communicate those ideas to the minds of people 2,000 years ago? I mean, how would you communicate this to somebody 2,000 years ago, what this can do? You'd either have to write an extremely long book, or you would have to use a lot of symbolism. That's just one thing. So the other thing is, sometimes this type of literature is gripping to our souls. Remember a couple months ago now, I guess it is a month and a half ago, we had Dr. Saxoneri preached out of Ezekiel. Ezekiel uses apocalyptic type literature as well. And he talked about that giant war chariot and all the faces in it and stuff. I mean, you're doing that so that your mind and your soul is gripped by the power of something, or the terror of something, or the majesty of something. And you're trying to communicate ideas. Poetry works in a similar but different way. So this is just another way to communicate ideas to people. I'd love to spend more time about that. But just in general, apocalyptic literature is a helpful medium, even if it seems foreign and strange to us. Letter B. It is clear that the book of Revelation, contains or exhibits some similarity to other apocalyptic literature. However, there are some differences as well. These differences include some of the following points. One, John does not use a pseudonym. In other words, he doesn't write under a false name. Two, the book of Revelation focuses on the present and future rather than a recitation of the past. That makes it a little bit different. Revelation has a more optimistic view of the future than other apocalypses. For the substance of the biblical apocalypses differs greatly from non-canonical writings. In other words, it contains very specific prophecies concerning the future. And that's also what makes the book of Revelation unique. And let me see if I can get my PowerPoint to come back on after it just... Pay no attention to the screen up there. All right. We'll do that. Okay. Where were we? We're to get into the author, right? Is that right? Top page 123? What's that? 122C.
It's 122 for us.
What's that? Oh, yeah. All right. Letter C. There we go. Sorry. In light of these factors, it seems best to consider biblical apocalyptic literature to be an entirely separate class of genre. One of the keys there is very specific prophecies that come to play in a number of places. Now, this is another question that some people have is, well, if there are differences, why would you use this type of literature to communicate these ideas from God? Well, just in general, many of the New Testament types of literature uses differences. For instance, Paul's letters are technically of the epistolary genre. The type of literature is letter, but his is different than most of the ancient Near East letters that you will see. Right, or ancient Greco-Roman letters that you will see. They're typically much longer than most of those other letters. More than likely, God is using a form of literature that people in the day that Revelation was given would understand and know. And he uses some variations, but within the theme of apocalyptic literature, it would be known and understood by people. We just don't use as much of that literature today. Although, I suspect, actually, this kind of thing is actually going to come back into the imaginations of people. For instance, there's a massive revival right now of using classic Greco-Roman style of literature to in terms of fantasy today. That's coming back. You have really popular versions of that, like the Percy Jackson stuff. But there is more like really heady stuff that people are using. I would actually bet that apocalyptic literature will come back in vogue again, especially because we live in a very pessimistic age. Doomsday is kind of like in the back of a lot of people's minds, even if you don't think it's actually going to come from God. So that's just cultural speculation. Again, we could talk a long time about that. But for a long time, apocalyptic literature was very popular. Now let's think just a little bit, number four, about the interpretation of the book of Revelation. So regarding the interpretation of the book of Revelation, each of the three elements of the genre of the book should be noted and interpreted appropriately. So, when you are letter B in the epistolary form of the book, that's largely in the very beginning, chapters 1 through 3 in the last few verses of chapter 22, that's the letter type. When you're in that form of the book, it should remind the interpreter that the instructions of the book were written to address a real need in the Christian community. There's your blanks there. Real need. Oh, actually, I just have it underlined. I didn't put a blank in there. In the Christian community. And that's particularly true concerning the letters to the churches. Letter C. As prophetic literature, several principles should be observed that are common to all biblical prophecy. So you need to use this grid of interpretation. One, prophets had twofold ministries, both as foretellers of God's message and foretellers of future events. So a prophet sometimes says, this is what God thinks about you and your life and your situation now. And sometimes prophets would say from God, this is what's going to happen in the future. That's the difference between foretelling future and forthtelling right now. So you got to think about that when you're reading prophetic literature. Two, prophets used a variety of means to communicate their messages. Lots of different means. Sometimes poetry, sometimes imaginative literature, sometimes like real life illustrations, you know, things like that. Three, a predictive prophecy is normally selective in what it communicates. It's a very narrow field, usually. Four, predictive prophecy must be interpreted within the larger context of biblical theology, especially biblical eschatology. That's the doctrine of last things. In other words, if you think you found something that's really weird in a particular book of the Bible, you need to make sure that it fits with the rest of what the Bible says about future things. Five, to interpret predictive prophecy, look for interpretive clues, beginning with the immediate context and moving outward to the canonical context, that is, the whole of the Bible. So you start where you're at in your immediate chapter, a few verses, move out to the whole of the book, and then the whole of the Bible. And predictive prophecy may be fulfilled in a number of ways. Some of those ways are things that have already have been fulfilled, will be fulfilled yet. So just some general rules about prophecy. A lot more we could say there. And we did cover some of that when we went through our hermeneutics course in here. And we're actually going to cover more of that in those of you who are in the advanced Bible study class. Letter D. The apocalyptic element of the book of Revelation adds some additional challenges for the interpreter, especially since there are so many symbolic descriptions given in the book. Here's some additional principles that should be observed. First of all, when interpreting symbols in Revelation, here's number one, move from the known to unknown. Start with what you know for sure. Number two, symbols and figures should be interpreted as literally as possible. And this is important. Even, number three, if figurative, symbols have a real referent, R-E-F-E-R-E-N-T, real referent, R-E-F-E-R-E-N-T. Here's what that means. Even if it is purely symbolic, that symbol refers to something real. So you can't just make up whatever you feel like it should mean to you. And this is a good dose of humility. The interpreter must acknowledge the limitations of his or her historical position. We are 1900 years separated from John's writing of the book of Revelation. And these words are okay to say when you're interpreting the Bible. I don't know. That's okay to say. Now, that's not okay to say just to punt and ignore hard questions. But it is okay to say that. I don't know. And there are some things in Revelation that you might get that way. And now let's talk about the book of Revelation itself. The author of the book of Revelation identifies himself as John at least four times in the book. Four times in the book. You can look those all up. John, we know, was a prisoner on the island of Patmos for the sake of Christ. It's also clear from the book itself that John functioned as a prophet, communicating God's message to others. Letter B, thinking about the author. Although the author of Revelation does not designate himself as an apostle, it is the unanimous testimony of the earliest church tradition that the book was written by John the Apostle. That consensus was challenged in the middle of the third century, notably by Dionysius of Alexandria, and he objected. He was an early form critic, or, you know, remember we talk about all these modern critics who criticize, saying, oh, one author couldn't write different styles. Well, he came up with that in the third century. And he said that Revelation, the style, was too different from the other writings of John, so that couldn't be written by him. However, this is important to note, that his criticism seemed to be motivated by a distaste for the millennialism, or Killeism, that was taught by the book, and he rejected the book altogether. So if you think that, you know, it's all new about people not liking certain books of the Bible or teachings from the Bible, no, it's not new, it's old as well. I believe, if I remember correctly, when we talk about the unanimous testimony, maybe I have this elsewhere listed as well. I think I do, actually. Ignatius is a guy who lives, he's born in like 130 AD and dies in like 200 AD. He was a disciple of a man named Polycarp. And Polycarp was a direct disciple of the Apostle John. So you're talking just a couple of generations there. And Ignatius, over and over again, identifies John the Apostle as the writer of Revelation. He's in the best possible position to know. So, pretty clear. What about the date? Scholars generally assume that the book of Revelation was written during a time of organized official persecution of Christians by the Roman Empire. And you see that element come through several times in the early part of the book. Persecution is on the horizon. Two major views are typically defended, either the end of the reign of Nero in the mid-60s or that it was written at the end of the reign of Domitian in the mid-90s. The Domitian date has the most to commend it. And here, this is the name I was looking for. This position stands on the firmest church tradition, Irenaeus, who both identified John as the writer and also said when it was written. And it's supported by a number of other historical considerations, and you can read those there. So this would make John writing this as a very old man, shortly before he died. And the reign of Domitian was a very harsh reign. A lot of persecution was leveled against the people of the Lord. I don't have my remote up here to kill this. Was this distracting everybody looking at amazing views of the cities? Yeah. Tim, do you want to grab that remote for me up there? I'll turn it off. I think that's Dubai. Thank you. What's the theme and purpose? The next three words are my favorite in this entire presentation about Revelation. God will triumph. However you read the book, that's what should come out in the end. Now, there are brothers and sisters who read the book of Revelation differently than I do. I'll talk about some of them in just a moment. But they still see that theme as coming out through this book. And in that I rejoice. God will triumph. The book contains letters to the seven churches in Asia Minor and John's vision of eschatological events, future events. The purpose of the book of Revelation is to offer hope to believers and encourage them to faithfulness to Christ. That's also important as well, because if you read the book of Revelation as a scare tactic for your soul, I think you're really missing the point. You should read the book of Revelation and recognize Jesus is going to win. The just will be rewarded. The unjust will be punished forever. The only person that should scare is an unbeliever. If you're a believer, it should encourage you. What about the historical background? Well, the stated recipients of the book of Revelation are the seven churches of Asia Minor. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. This is where I do wish I had the map up. We've shown this region before. It's in modern Turkey. John's writing on the Isle of Patmos, and he writes this letter and sends this to the seven churches. Now, the seven churches each had their own distinctive character and faced their own particular challenges. Letter B, the order in which the cities are listed, and note this word, seems, I think it's probably very likely, seems to follow the path that a messenger would have taken to deliver the letters. Don't know that for certain, but sort of if we had a map, we'd see where Patmos was, and you'd follow the order, and you'd realize there's a logical order to where they would go traveling-wise. Probably the case. As I mentioned, at the time of Revelation, John was exiled to the Isle of Patmos. He identifies that in chapter 1 and verse 9. It's a small, rocky, desolate island. It's located in the Aegean Sea. It was used by the Romans as an exile for criminals and political offenders. Let us see, the historical factor that seems to tie these churches together is persecution for the faith. And whether you see that in the mid-60s or in the late 90s or the mid-90s, the reality is that that was on the horizon whenever this was written. Churches in the midst of persecution be tempted to compromise, whether abandoning the faith or compromise on the things that caused the persecution to happen to them. And Revelation reminded the early church, as it does to us today, not to quit. Lord will win. The book of Revelation, as I mentioned, we've already talked about this a little bit more earlier in the New Testament prophecy section, so I won't rehash all of that. Essentially, this is kind of a repeat of what we talked about in a little fuller sense up above, but it follows the format that we have been going through. Theology. The most significant of the theological contributions of the book of Revelation is to the area of eschatology. Eschatology, E-C-C-H-A-T-O-L-O-G-Y. The book discusses a host of eschatological persons and events. The biblical eschatology, and this is talking about future things, is... biblical eschatology, of the rest of the Bible is enlightened and supplemented the teaching of Revelation. And it's very relevant to themes like the tribulation period, coming judgment, and the millennial kingdom. Revelation also makes a significant contribution to the doctrine of God, that is theology proper, and its emphasis on the sovereignty of God. Sovereignty of God. No matter what happens, God's in control, and he will direct human history to his desired end. And you see that even when you go into all that apocalyptic literature of, you know, you've got judgments and famine and fire and all kinds of stuff coming down. But in all of that, God's in control. He's orchestrating each one of those things. Often not with, by the way, without a direct hand. He uses other agents to execute his will. But in all of it, God's in control. He's ruling, he's reigning. Letter C, Revelation also maintains a high Christology, that is the doctrine of Jesus Christ. Jesus is worthy of divine worship. Letter C, he's worthy of divine worship and exercises divine authority. And angels also receive a good deal of attention to the book of Revelation as they offer praise and worship to God and serve as his messengers. I probably should have broken that out to a separate letter. Finally, Revelation makes a contribution to ecclesiology, that is the doctrine of the church. Ekklesia is the Greek word for church or ecclesia. And that the church is not mentioned in chapters 4 through 18. And this omission, I think, favors the dispensational pre-tribulational conclusion that the church will not be present on earth during this period of time because it will have been raptured prior to these events. Key issues, number 7. In general, there are 4 basic hermeneutical, that is the science of how you're interpreting something, 4 basic hermeneutical approaches to Revelation. One is the preterist view, P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-T, P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-T. The preterist view believes that the events of Revelation were accomplished in John's day. That's a fairly common view. It's becoming more common today. The historical view, number 2, historical view, believes that the events of Revelation are fulfilled in the history of the Christian church. They will often trace that through the 7 letters to the churches and say that each one of those represents epochs of time within the history of the church. Number 3, the idealistic view, getting ahead of myself, which is ironic for future. The idealistic view believes that the events of Revelation generally do not have a specific historical fulfillment, but teach general principles about how God works throughout history. So this is just symbolic of God's power and rule. And then the futurist view believes that the events of Revelation will be fulfilled in a future of time preceding the second advent of Christ. Now, the trend among recent scholars is to blend these approaches, taking aspects from all 4. In light of the way the Old Testament prophecies have been fulfilled, example, literally from in Christ's first coming, the futurist view has the most to commend it. This allows for a definite historical fulfillment and allows the book to be interpreted in a more normal, and this is important to me, less subjective manner. The problem you're going to discover is when you take one of those other views is that when you start reading people about that, they are all over the map as to what things mean because they don't remember we talked about those symbols have a real referent. If you don't believe that, then you start getting just stuff all over. It's just really hard. Now, that's not to say that futurists like myself in Revelation sometimes don't have disagreements. We do, but they're actually on the whole relatively minimal. Now, letter B, because one's interpretive approach is related to one's eschatological preference, it's good to review the basic millennial positions. There are 3 millennial views. 3 millennial views. First is the post-millennial. The post-millennial person believes that Christ will return after the millennium. So, in that sense, we are working to bring in the kingdom of Christ. When he comes, he will make all things right. The amillennialists, A-M-I-L-L-E-N-I-A-L-I-S-T. Ah, you have there just the A in front of that. They believe the millennium is fulfilled in the church, though many would also see that there are future elements in the book of Revelation, at least some. That, by the way, amillennialists do believe that there is a coming culmination when Christ comes and he puts an end to all rule and authority and all of that. But they believe that much of the millennial features are actually active and present now. They're in part, we're waiting for the whole. Number three, the pre-millennialists, just adding the word pre there, believes that the return of Christ will precede his millennial kingdom. And that, by the way, is what our church teaches, that third view. And very clearly in our documents, our statement of faith, and what we would teach here. Now, dispensational premillennialism, which is a subset of premillennialism, maintains a sharp distinction between Israel and the church and maintains that the unfulfilled promises made to Israel are not being fulfilled figuratively in the church today, but will be fulfilled literally in the future. So that is historically what we've taught for quite some time here, long before me as well. Now, letter C, as we think about key issues, Revelation is rich in its use of symbols. That just becomes obvious if you just have a cursory reading of the book. There are dangers in interpreting such symbols either too literally or not literally enough. And I'll just admit, this is a hard, hard thing. Another key issue, letter D, the seal. You'll see when you read through Revelation, you have the seal judgments, the trumpet, and the bowl judgments. They appear to have some chronological sequence, but each successive series seems to flow out of the previous one. I think most interpreters today would hold that. So you have the seven seals. The seventh seal is actually the opening of the seven trumpets. And the seventh trumpet is the opening of the seven bowl judgments. That might help you if you're just reading through Revelation to remember that. Letter E, Revelation is also distinctive in its use of the Old Testament. But this is interesting. While the book abounds with allusions to the Old Testament, there are a lot of them. In fact, one of the things you should do if you want to seriously interpret Revelation is make sure you understand Ezekiel and Daniel really well, and that will help you in Revelation. Read through them, and it will just help you a lot. But this is interesting. The book does not contain a single direct quotation of the Old Testament. There's clear allusions to it, but not direct quotations. This also, some critics of the book bring this up, modern critics. Revelation was accepted by the Western Church, and it was included without reservation in the earliest list of canonical works. However, beginning in the 3rd century, we met one of those guys earlier, Revelation met opposition in the East, where Kileism, that is a reference to the literal thousand-year millennium taught therein, was rejected by many, including the man Eusebius, who was a church historian. So they didn't like the theology of the book, so they questioned it. That, by the way, is also important to note that you'll have some people say that this whole idea of a millennial kingdom, that's a new invention, just not true. We have clear documents in the 2nd and 3rd century of great respected Bible teachers and preachers and pastors then who did teach in a millennial kingdom of some sort. Not as developed as we might like, but they clearly taught it. But there were some who were opposed to that. So the debate about Revelation and how to interpret it is very old. It's been going on a long, long time. And I just want to emphasize that although I have a particular view on the book, and if I would teach it and preach it, I would passionately teach and preach that view, I do want to emphasize that we can also have at the same rate a degree of humility to recognize there are other people who are going to come at this in a different way, but they're also going to say in the end, God triumphs, and that's the point. And in that, rejoice in that. Okay? So you can hold something firmly, but also be gracious in differences. And then you can have some things there about the structure of the book. You can read that on your own time, and we've got a basic outline of the book as well. Actually, truthfully, outlining the book is not very difficult. You just read through it. It becomes pretty clear on the breaking points throughout it. So, all right. I'm over time, so I need to stop. So, but we finished New Testament survey. God willing, in June, we're going to start a new series on the doctrine of God, theology proper. So we will see on that, what that looks like. I was scheduled to teach that, and most of you got the news probably via the prayer chain that we did receive word that our paperwork is signed by the Liberian government offices. We actually do have a travel date at this point. We are leaving, God willing, June 22nd. So, I don't know yet if there'll be one trip or two. So I'll say a little bit more about that in the morning service. That may change what we do for the summer for Sunday school at some point. But we'll keep you posted on that. So, thanks so much. You're dismissed. We'll see you in the morning worship service.